Greetings, friends. Welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the film review podcast, where we review films with a sound effect. There it is.
Yes.
You chose a good one this time.
We would also review silent movies if they came up, but they don't lately. So most of the movies you review do have sound effects.
It's true. I'm trying to think. I've seen a few films recently that have, like, very little dialogue.
Sure. But no like sound effects? Like pretty uncommon.
Timing Liang's Days has very little, if any, important words exchange.
But you know what? These days, everyone needs a good Foley artist.
Yes, indeed.
Damn right. Anyway, my name is William Bibbiani. I'm a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. And before I introduce myself, I bring up Simon Lang. So you can kind of know what you're in for.
Another one of those podcasts. Yeah, everyone's all sick of them. Like, when will these film critics stop talking about Simon Lang? Anyway.
Wouldn't that be great if all of these journalists who are grilling every single filmmaker about Marvel movies?
Yeah.
Like, it inevitably comes up. I'm not exactly sure why. But what if they just asked about Simon Lang instead?
Yeah.
It's like, hey, Scorsese, what do you think about Simon Lang? And I bet he has a lot of things to say.
I'll bet he does, actually.
Denis Villeneuve, what do you think?
I wouldn't be surprised whatsoever if Denis Villeneuve had strong opinions as well. But, people like the Marvel movies. But we're not doing Marvel movies. Oh, no.
Not this week.
Nope, this week we got some new releases. We're reviewing the new film, The Eyes of Tammy Faye, starring Jessica Chastain and Andrew Garfield. We're reviewing the new Clint Eastwood movie, Cry Macho, starring Clint Eastwood. We've got the new Netflix horror kids movie, Nightbooks, and the new Melanie Lynskey, Judy Greer supernatural comedy, Lady of the Manor. It's a big week, and there's stuff we didn't even get to.
No, there's a new Sion Sono film that we both are disappointed at having missed.
Yep. Kind of pissed off, actually. It looks really cool. Nicolas Cage in, like, a leather suit that explodes in different parts depending on whether he's, like, does things wrong. Like, okay, well, then your arm will explode or wiener will explode. And it's
Someone was kind enough to post a clip, a very brief clip of Nicolas Cage in that movie just screaming the word testicles as loud as he can. So I'm quite disappointed that I missed seeing
We'll get to that eventually, and we're sorry we can't bring you that now. But in the meantime, let's get started. And let's start with... Should we start with... What do you want to start with?
I saw a movie in a theater, so why don't we talk about The Eyes of Tammy Faye?
Let's do it.
Because that one's not on streaming services right now.
Not at the moment. No. The Eyes of Tammy Faye is a new film from director Michael Showalter. Michael Showalter got his start as a comedian on the sketch comedy series The State. Mm-hmm. You might remember him as Doug, and he was out of here.
One of many roles. They all played multiple roles.
He was a very, very...
Sketch comedy program.
That's where I was introduced to him. He was very, very funny. He was also in Wet Hot American Summer. And then he's actually been directing more, and he directed the Oscar-nominated film...
The Big Sick.
The Big Sick, thank you. I don't know how I blanked on that real fast. But The Big Sick, which is a great movie. Like, a legitimately great movie.
He wrote... he co-wrote the screenplay for a really funny comedy called They Came Together.
Mm-hmm.
And he directed a film called Hello, My Name is Doris with Sally Field, which I'm very fond of. It's about a lonely hoarder who learns to socialize in ways she hadn't before.
Yeah, really underappreciated Sally Field performance in that movie. She's really wonderful in that film.
He did The Big Sick. He did a comedy film last year, also with Kumail Nanjiani, called The Lovebirds, which I wasn't so fond of.
It was okay. It was a little more formulaic. But here he is doing... it's funny, but it's definitely a drama. And it is the story of Tammy Faye Baker, played by Jessica Chastain, who, along with her husband, Jim Baker, they were two of the biggest televangelists of the 1980s, back when Christian television was having a huge surge in popularity, and the format of, we will give you entertainment and you call in and give us money to continue doing these good works, started to become a huge industry. Gigantic industry. And it turned out, and this is not a spoiler, this is all reality. This is all most people know about them nowadays. Turns out that Jim and Tammy Faye Baker spent a lot of that money on themselves. A lot of that money on themselves. But now we have a drama that people have been trying to make. There's a documentary called The Eyes of Tammy Faye, came out about 20 years ago, and now here we have a feature film about.
Yeah. This was a time I remember very vividly, the sort of the ascendancy of the televangelist. And televangelists were, at least in the circles I ran, not well-respected human beings.
They had their fan base, and amongst that fan base, they were very, very popular.
Yeah.
And mostly everyone else that I was aware of didn't think very highly of them.
Yeah, there was Oral Roberts, he has his university. I've been to Oral Roberts University in Tulsa, Oklahoma, just visiting as a tourist. Oral Roberts built, it essentially looks like the Seattle Space Needle, which was like his special prayer conduit. Like, he'd go into this private space in this weird science fiction looking building he had built, and that's the only place where he could communicate with God.
So a Tower of Babel.
More or less, yeah. No irony in the world of televangelism. Wow. Jim and Tammy Faye Baker were early proponents of what's known as prosperity theology.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, if you are doing good works, if you are doing God's work, you deserve to have money. And if you are wealthy, that's a sign that God is smiling on you.
Yeah, there's the long been in organized religion, particularly Christianity, this idea that, I mean, it's in the Bible, isn't it? Like, it's easier to get a camel through the eye of a needle than it is to get a rich person into heaven.
Right.
I'm paraphrasing, but that's the gist. And there was
this is a translation.
But the general idea is that piety doesn't come with financial reward.
Mm.
And in fact, those two things are often diametrically opposed. And what Jim and Tammy Faye Baker were espousing was there is absolutely no shame in being financially successful.
Mm.
That's not a sin in and of itself. It's a matter of what you do with it. And, you know, there's definitely an appeal to that, but when you realize that this is a level of, like, it seems like, you know, maybe that's not so bad, but then they take it to its logical extreme within their own lifetimes, and you see just how bad that can get.
So, Jim and Tammy Faye Baker were early televangelists, and they were also believed in Christianity as sort of showmanship.
Yeah.
And, you know, you talk to any clergy person, and they'll tell you that there is, reacting with an audience, there is sort of a show element to preaching.
When you preach, when you give a sermon, you're in front of a crowd, and it is your responsibility to keep them engaged.
But Jim and Tammy Faye Baker started including puppets and really kind of simplified messages so they could reach, you know, broader audiences. They traveled around with a puppet show for a little while. It wasn't until they saw Pat Robertson on TV that they got the idea, oh, wait, we could do that too. So they started their own TV network, and that grew by leaps and bounds. People started mailing them in money. They, and then more and more money. They expanded the TV show, and you watch some of these shows, and there's a lot of God talk, but there's not a lot of theology or philosophizing in it.
The hard questions aren't really being answered. It's basically very reassuring.
Yeah, it's all very they're bromides, and then there's things like we're also gonna have like early talk show segments, like where you're just gonna have a conversation about frosting cupcakes, things that have nothing to do with anything. And a lot of it was very musically inclined, and Tammy Faye Baker was there to sing. She loved to sing, and she co-ran all of this with Jim Baker. They were both essentially business people.
Yeah.
And they got into a lot of trouble because their church was a business that was tax-exempt.
Yeah.
And they said, well, this is all part of spreading God's word, when really it was just raking in money, building buildings, keeping themselves comfortable.
So that's the overarching, like, that's the sort of the backdrop of the movie. The actual centerpiece of the movie for me, though, is Jessica Chastain and Andrew Garfield's performances. And I think they are absolutely wonderful in this movie. I think they're great together.
Definitely. Because at the start of the movie, we get to see kind of how sort of optimistic they are and how great everything is going for them and how happy this is making them.
Yeah. Michael Showalter depicts them as naive children.
Yeah.
They've got big ideas in their heads, and everyone's like, oh, they'll learn the hard way, and then whoops, they succeeded.
And their moral center, who is played by the excellent Cherry Jones.
Oh, yeah.
She plays Tammy Faye's mom.
Yeah. Really underappreciated.
Is the one who keeps on asking them, "What are you doing here? This is not Christianity. What you're doing?" But they just smile and say, I made a puppet, a Porky Pig puppet, and this is actually a good way to spread God's word. And she kind of, like, looks at them a little askance.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, as the film continues, we do get to see that they kind of got in way over their heads, as the film depicts them. Mm-hmm. That they sort of lost control of this thing they created.
They succeeded way more than they should have, and they ended up being responsible for way too much.
They attract the attention of Pat Robertson, and they also attract the attention of the other great performance in this film, Vincent D'Onofrio, who plays Jerry Falwell.
Yeah.
Jerry Falwell is a fucking monster, and Jerry Falwell had a very open anti-gay slant to his.
I wouldn't even call preaching. It a slant. Like,
his purpose. It's like we have to stop homosexuality.
Yeah.
He said that openly, and he was disgusted with Jim and Tammy Faye Baker because Tammy Faye Baker, unlike a lot of these televangelists, was very open to the gay community.
Yeah, she saw them as people. Mm-hmm. Because, yes! And there's a bit in the movie where it's actually just her just talking to people who are gay and talking to people who have AIDS at the time of the AIDS crisis when everyone else was trying just not talk about it in public in the conservative community. And that... Win Tammy Faye a lot of bonus points with a lot of people, even after everything went down, because there just some credit had to be given to her for that.
And it was an issue, and the film rather frustratingly only brushes up against this.
Yeah.
But the way this network of televangelists was incredibly vital to Reagan's right wing back in the early 1980s.
Yeah.
And how these very bigoted points of views were being proliferated through these televangelists as mouthpieces for the Republican Party.
Yeah.
I don't even like to call them churches. These sort of bigot businesses were a big part of politics at the time. And I feel like, you know, Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, Jim Baker especially, is depicted as being very naive about what part he's playing in all of this, but
how unaware he is of his own desire to simply be famous and powerful.
Clearly
is, but he doesn't. I'm willing to admit it even to himself.
That part I don't mind, but they surely were far more aware of the power they were wielding to a large public.
This is where the movie like comes up a little short for me. I think Jerry Jones as well, but I think Andrew Garfield and Jessica Chastain are completely wonderful in this movie. I think they find a lot of interesting facets of these characters a lot of people might not have even wanted to look for. But I feel like the movie itself, as presented by Showalter and others, it's a little afraid to get as damning as it probably deserves to be.
Yeah.
I feel as though, because they're so interested in making sure that we have some affection for the Bakers, and I think the actors are doing most of the heavy lifting there anyway. They're not really getting into the two really big underlying themes here, which is one, the enormous hypocrisy of church for profit. And two, the schism in Christianity between people who wanted to use it as a means to exclusively promote bigotry and people who actually did have some interest in, you know, love and stuff. And the irony that the Bakers were kind of both of those things is that they were enormous hypocrites when it came to exploiting the word of God for financial profit, but also cared. And I think there's something about that that's way more interesting than the movie is able to handle for more than a minute or two at a time.
Yeah,
there's a couple of minutes where they're actively engaging
really
with that.
It's really tantalizing for a second.
And then they never really follow up on it very, very well and make the movie actually about that. And it ends up feeling more, at the end, like a really good character piece than what it really could have been, which is kind of about the entire system through the lens of these two.
I
feel like it almost gets there. It never quite does. It's not capital G great, but it's still quite good.
What I find really fascinating is I've reached the age now where they're making biographies of media figures from my own lifetime.
Yeah.
Tanya is another example of this. Tanya Harding was, she was a joke. yes, in the media.
Very quickly.
She was mocked relentlessly and satirized openly. And the same is true of Tammy Faye. And I'm actually glad there's a montage in this film of stuff I remember from my own childhood about Tammy Faye Baker, like being satirized on Saturday Night Live or being mentioned by comedians. Several of my friends had the t-shirt that they depict in this movie, where it's like a big splatter of makeup and sort of a vague face. Mm-hmm. And it says, "I ran into Tammy Faye at the mall."
I got it.
Tammy Faye Baker was notorious for her ostentatious look.
Yeah.
She wore very loud dresses. She had very wild hairdos. And she did wear a lot of makeup.
A lot of makeup, yeah.
And yeah, that's sort of what she was infamous for.
Well, that was the easiest thing to poke
fun at.
And as a result, that's where a lot of people started and where a lot of people stopped.
Exactly. And that she was involved with this scandal of, you know, this church that was just sort of taking money and keeping it for themselves. That her her husband also was caught up in a sex scandal.
Oh, yeah.
As they all were, weren't they?
Yeah.
Look up the famous phrase associated with Jimmy Swaggart at some point.
It's interesting because a lot of the stuff that's going on with Jim Baker in this movie, Jim Baker's played by Andrew Garfield, a lot of the stuff is actually off camera, because in the end of the day, the movie is told from Tammy Faye's perspective.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of stuff with Jim that's actually like a little bit at arm's length. And it's another one where I feel like, you know, it was perfectly fine to let this be a two-hander. It's perfectly fine to show us his perspective little bit more.
Well, but this film, just like the documentary film that it's based on, there's a 2000 documentary film also called The Eyes of Tammy Faye. It's trying to redeem her. Jim Baker, according to both of these narratives, is the less redeemable one. He's the one who committed the crimes. He's the one who went to prison. Tammy Faye was far more modest and honest in her approach to the world. And in fact, I think some of the more interesting scenes are near the end of the movie, where Jim Baker's already in prison. What has happened to Tammy Faye now?
Yeah.
And there's a wonderful scene where she just sort of gets out of her car, and she has some snarky teenage neighbors who are kind of laughing at her from afar.
Oh, I love that scene.
And she walks up to them and introduces herself.
Yeah.
Saying, I'm a human being. Let's have a conversation. She's actually very kind.
Yeah.
And by all accounts, Tammy Faye Baker was quite a kind human being. A little bit outlandish.
Yeah. But who can't
say, but kind?
You know, if that's the... If it's not the worst you could say about her, but if that was the worst you could say about somebody... Nice.
Yeah.
Obviously, there was more going on. But, I think this... Comparing this to I, Tonya is a really good one. Because I think Tonya Harding and Tammy Faye Baker, their legacy is way more superficial than the people they actually were.
Yeah.
They made serious mistakes. And I'm not even saying I forgive them for the things that they have done. But they're human beings. Mm. And the biopics that we've seen illuminate who they were as human beings, not just as a pop culture punchline, not just this one single thing they did in their life. You do get a grander sense of who they were and how the events of their lives and the choices that they made led them to the thing that they are now notorious for.
Mm.
That's good biopic storytelling.
Yeah.
That's what we should want from a biopic, is to actually feel like we know people better.
Yeah,
I think that's the bare minimum we should ask for.
This, however, I think is a little bit more than Michael Showalter as a director can chew.
Maybe
he bit off a little more than he can chew.
Great character work, but as a larger, like, grand mission statement, maybe he's not there yet.
It's also his biggest production. You compare the look of this to, like, The Big Sick. He just brought a camera into an apartment. Like, there's like
it's a good looking movie. Come on.
The Big Sick is not a good looking movie.
It does what it needs to do.
The characters, the acting, the story, all of that is wonderful in The Big Sick.
I like that.
The writing is wonderful in the movie, but it looks like they're filming at just some guy's apartment.
They are just filming at some guy's apartment, and it is drab. I think they
did nothing to like give it any kind of look, is my point. It looks really amateurish.
I think you're being a little harsh, but okay. I'll let it go. I like it more than you.
I love the movie. I just think it's drab and ugly.
I see your point, but I disagree.
But you compare it to this movie, this is like production design and really slick. Clearly they're working with a much bigger budget. And I think Michael Showalter is doing really good to balance all of these big stars in this bigger production, but he's not delving into the material quite as deeply as I think he either would like to or just didn't aim to.
The material, it'd be one thing if the material never went there.
Yeah.
And this was simply a character piece, and this was just like almost like a chamber room piece between just the two of them, that would probably have been a very good movie. But no, the movie keeps bringing up these grander ideas and this idea that these characters are... You can unlock an entire generation or an entire new wave of Christian ideology just through looking at them. And you think about movies that were able to, whether they were fictional or you know, thinly veiled, that were able to illustrate such a thing. Look at Citizen Kane, for example. Mm. And look at the way that that movie depicts, you know, this birth of the 20th century and the birth of this like mass mainstream journalism through the perspective of this one character, at least the opinion, the how people felt about this one character.
Yeah.
That's a tall order. I'm not saying this movie needs to be Citizen Kane, but my point is that the movie could have had some ambition and gone a little bit beyond just the characters.
The idea, I feel like visiting sort of the golden age of televangelism in like the early to mid 80s is an important era to visit because Fox News is a direct child of this. This sort of proselytizing, using television to spread essentially a very specific agenda, kind of sprung forth from this particular flavor of it, sprung forth from televangelism. Yeah. And I feel like this was a good opportunity to start to do that, and they didn't do it. So it was a little disappointing.
Yeah. But there's room for... there's, if anyone else wants to do something a bit grander, there'd be a good TV show out of something like this.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
But in any case, ultimately not maybe as good as it could have been, but I'm glad we both liked it. Let's talk about the next new release. This is a film starring and directed by Clint Eastwood at the age of 91, which is, there aren't a lot of people who continue working in the industry in Hollywood until that age. And it's actually really, really cool that we get to have filmmakers with that perspective still getting to tell stories, because this is a very youth-oriented industry.
And Clint Eastwood, who filmed this when he was 90, is still playing a 60-year-old.
Did they actually say his age?
They never say his age.
That's the thing. But the character seems to be treated like a 60-year-old, but Clint Eastwood seems to be playing him like a 90-year-old. Well, so I'm never really 100% sure how, because I know some people were saying, like, he's too old for this role. I thought the point was that he was too old.
He's an old guy, but he... Clint Eastwood has been playing the "I'm getting too old for this" since as long ago as Unforgiven.
I think even before the last like one or two like Dirty Harry movies. He was still
like I'm getting too old for this. The aged out cowboy, and he's been doing the aged out cowboy longer than he was doing cowboys now.
That's true.
In this one, he's playing a cowboy. He plays a former rodeo star.
It's present day, by the way.
Yeah, set in the present day, and he's hired by a friend of his, played by Dwight Yoakam.
Who speaks only in exposition. Like, it's an incredible performance. Like, every single line of dialogue he has is just exposition. It's a bit clunky, honestly.
A bit.
But
Dwight Yoakam hires his friend, Clint Eastwood, for quite a large amount of money. Dwight Yoakam is very rich. To go to Mexico and find his estranged 13-year-old son.
Yeah.
Who's his mother... took him to Mexico, and his mother is evidently some sort of bigwig in like local crime in Mexico.
Yeah, and Dwight Yoakam tells Clint Eastwood that he's concerned that his son is being abused somehow, and he wants Clint Eastwood to... he can't go down to Mexico for legal reasons. Fair enough. I guess he's also not a very good person. He's got some shit on his rap sheet. But he says, Clint Eastwood, will you please go down to Mexico, find my 13-year-old son, and bring him up here, please. Mm. And Clint Eastwood says, who really apparently owes Dwight Yoakam one. Like, that's the whole point of the scene, is Dwight Yoakam saying, dude, you've been a drunk, you've been a layabout, you were a terrible rodeo guy for so long, I've cut you slack for so many decades, you owe me.
We say he's former rodeo star. He was a rodeo star back in the 70s, like a long, long time ago, and he injured his back. And
he's been coasting on that for a long time.
And he's been like teaching horseback riding ever since then. Yeah.
So he goes down to Mexico, and he finds the kid, and the kid, he's a little punk. You know, he's been working in a cockfighting ring. And the most endearing thing about the whole movie is that the kid refuses to go anywhere without his rooster.
His rooster, who is Macho.
His name is Macho. Clint Eastwood and the kid absconds with the kid, even though the mom says, you're not making it out of Mexico. And they end up on the run. And they end up, most of the movie is actually them hiding out in a small town, like just out in the middle of nowhere, just waiting it out, waiting until like people stop looking for them. And it's just them getting comfortable in a community and this kid getting some sense of stability and Clint Eastwood having something to do with his life again.
Clint Eastwood has always been a very gentle director.
Mostly.
He's made some violent... High
Plains Drifter is a very fierce movie.
He dabbles in brutality. Mystic River is a pretty brutal film.
Excuse me.
Oh, you're dropping things. But he's made a good number of films that are very calm, even if they're dealing with pretty harrowing subject matter. So oftentimes to a fault, if you've ever seen his Jersey Boys, like, this is a musical and you're going to make it calming?
That movie has no energy.
Not at all.
No energy at all. It is such a shame, because that's good material. It's fun material, that movie. Ooh, not a fun film.
But yeah, films like Hereafter and Changeling, like, these things sort of gently crest, and this is... he's on camera again, and things are moving along very gently, and it is about how the Clint Eastwood character enters into people's circles, and they are just sort of calmed by his very presence.
Yeah.
According to the screenplay, he's a lot more active than we actually see Clint Eastwood acting.
Uh-huh.
There's a scene in the movie where the cops come by, and he has to sort of, like, duck behind something, like he's hiding from the cops.
Uh-huh.
But Clint Eastwood is 91. He's not going to, like, drop and roll on the ground.
No.
So he just sort of, like, walks behind a box and stays there.
There's a scene in which, in order to, like, earn his keep, Clint Eastwood has to help tame a horse.
Uh-huh.
There's, like, a guy with a ranch, and they have a wild horse, and he's like, yeah, I gotta break this horse, otherwise it won't be, like, domesticated. And Clint Eastwood's like, oh, I can do that. And he gets up on the horse, and then his stunt double does a lot of really good rodeo riding.
Nice long shot there.
And then we just cut to Clint Eastwood, and he's clearly in front of a screen. And listen, I'm going to tell you something right now. Clint Eastwood is 91 years old. I am not asking him to do his own horse stunts on a rodeo.
No.
That is completely inappropriate, but it is noticeable. It is a little noticeable.
What I want is for him to play a 90-year-old.
Yeah.
Not a 60-year-old. There's a scene earlier in the movie when he's talking to the boy's mother.
Mm.
And she's trying to sort of, like, coerce him into staying silent.
She's throwing herself
And she says, why don't you crawl into bed with me? And she's wearing, like, a nightie. And he's standing there like, and what am I going to do? Are you going to help me into bed?
Yeah. Well, it's not even
Like a virile 60-year-old who still might be able to bring it, then that's one thing.
That's why I was convinced that even though the movie kind of... Because originally this was based on a novel. The novel, the character is supposed to be younger. But I don't know. I don't see a problem with this being an older man so long as he does older man things. And the idea that someone would throw themselves at him sexually... And he would just be like, you know what, that's not where I'm at right now. I actually liked that. I reviewed this briefly, nowhere near as long as we got to do here on a KCRW last week. I did a show called Press Play with the great Amy Nicholson, wonderful film critic.
Yeah. She had me on her podcast once, a couple of years back.
She made the point that, you know, you can talk about, like, how gentle this movie is all you want, but Clint Eastwood's still kind of playing this, like, majorly, like, puffed-up version of himself where everything he does is wonderful, and the only two women in the movie just throw themselves at him immediately. And that's true. Yeah. I think that's fair to say. You know, Clint Eastwood has a persona, and he's been playing with it ever since he developed it. I think it's interesting how funny he thinks it is. That he has this persona that he's eager to, like, subvert it by, like, doing multiple movies with an orangutan sidekick. Or, like, doing this movie where he's got, like, funny scenes with a rooster. Like, he's not doing it unironically. I think he has some self-awareness of it. But it's true. He's playing his, you know, shit-kicker hero persona. What I like about this movie is how economical it is. There's... a lot of this movie that just Clint Eastwood knows we don't need to see.
Oh.
There's a bit where, you know, he's the kid's mom lives in a big estate, and she's having some sort of party or something the day that Clint Eastwood gets there. So he just, like, wanders in with the crowd.
Uh-huh.
And then we just see, like, two security guards look at him. And then we don't need the scene where he tries to blend in. We don't need the scene where they try to stop him. We don't need the scene where he acts tough. We don't need the scene where they threaten to rough him up. We don't need to build suspense that they take him into. It just cuts to the conversation later. Where it's just like, so you want my son, huh? Like, boom. We don't need any of that shit.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's something that is so impressively confident about that kind of storytelling where we're just going to cut through all the bullshit, and I know what this movie needs to get going, and I'm not going to bother with anything else. And I like that. I think that's actually cool to watch. I like...
I miss that kind of efficient filmmaking, that's for sure.
And I think that's kind of filmmaking that I tend to see mostly from older filmmakers who aren't trying to prove themselves by putting in a bunch of extraneous fun stuff. There's nothing wrong with that in theory, but there's a lot of filmmakers who, as they get older, just simplify.
Yeah.
And they don't do what they don't need to do. And there's something really elegant about that. I like Clint Eastwood's relationship with the kid. What is the kid's name? The actor.
The character was Raphael.
Yeah.
The actor is named Eduardo Minnett.
His name. And you know what? I think he shows a lot of promise. I think he's really, 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 really fun. I think they're sweet together. I think I like this. I don't love it, but it's maybe I think it's my favorite Clint Eastwood movie, and I've missed a couple of big ones.
Okay.
Like, I didn't see Gran Torino, or I didn't see J. Edgar. I've seen a couple of big ones, but
J. Edgar is a stinker.
But you know what I mean? But it was big. It was supposed to be, like, you know, built up a lot. But, like, there's a couple of major releases I haven't seen. But I think this is my favorite Clint Eastwood movie in quite a while.
Okay.
I just dug the vibe. I think Clint Eastwood was just more there for the vibe than anything else, really.
Yeah, well, at the end, it ends up striking as sort of a mood piece. Mm-hmm. It is a kind of a fantasy. There's a scene at the end where they just get to walk over the Mexican border, and that's like, wait a minute, what is...
Well, because there's a rich white guy on the other end.
I understand that.
Yeah, that I buy.
But there's like,
that the rules don't apply to a rich white guy.
It's just a road, and there's an open fence, like there's no, like...
Well, that's actually true for a lot of INS agents
or anything, but...
It's a big fucking border, okay?
There's no mention of, like... modern immigration messes that have been going on over the last couple of years.
The movie I kept thinking about while I was watching it was Rambo Last Blood. And the way that movie, because that movie is also about like an aging badass going into Mexico to bring a teenager back to America. Mm. But in that one, it's all about how Mexico is this horrible hellscape.
It's like hell. Yeah, filmed really dark really and awful. It's really
insulting and cruel. Just about like just the whole attitude about non-white people in that movie, and like there are like a few exception characters, but it feels like they're there to get away with just how transparently superficial they're going to treat anything negative about Mexico. Here there is more nuance than that, and here, you know, it's not about I'm going to kill everybody. He didn't kill anybody. He punches a guy once. Like, that's it. That's the whole action of the film. It's not about that, and I like that.
Yeah, it has a bit of the, it has kind of like a young adult novel feel to it to me.
I can see
like,
that.
And when I say young adult novel, like not the modern post Harry Potter stuff, but
like the Dear Mr. Henshaw kind of era, coming of age stories.
Yeah, or Hatchet. If you ever read a book like Hatchet when you were a kid, just a kind of young boy's adventure novel, but it was from the kid's very perspective, calming.
It would be that.
Yeah. It's like it's about an old ex cowboy and a boy with a pet chicken, and they're on the road together. And that's a book I might have got from the library when I was a kid.
Yeah,
It is based on a book as well. Clint Eastwood, I think, is trying to capture a little bit of that like plucky spirit. It's an oversimplified world. It's a calm world. It's not realistic at all.
Not particularly. And
that's not in reference to how Clint Eastwood is too old to be playing this part. It's just
everything's a little simple. Everything's a little clean. Everything's a little clean. But I mostly liked it.
So yeah, it has that kind of very calming, almost childlike view of the story. Well, and that can be appreciated.
Well, I think again, it's a Western. And it's a neo-Western. It's set in the present day, but it's still got that idea of, you know, here at the frontier, here, like, far away from where, you know, the hustle and bustle of urban living, things are a little bit more straightforward in some respects. Mm-hmm. And as a result, sometimes those things can get warped and people can do bad things. You know, the morality is what we make of it.
Yeah.
I dig this one. I dig it a lot. Okay. Tell me about, I wanted to make time for this because it looks really fun. I have no idea how it turned out. But tell me about the new Netflix movie, Nightbooks.
Nightbooks. Netflix action movies leave me cold. We reviewed Kate last week, and I just...
Yeah.
That movie angered me. I just did not like Kate.
A Netflix action movie.
I know Extraction got a lot of ballyhoo, but I did not like Extraction. I liked
a couple of good shots.
I liked The Old Guard. I thought that one was okay, but...
It was okay. I thought I thought the actual movie was fine. I thought all of the mythologizing was pretty crap.
Yeah. You know what? I liked Project Power. I thought that one was
alright. Oh, that one was good. That's actually one of the better superhero movies of the most recent years.
But where they're really knocking it out of the park between this and also the Fear Street movies is kids horror for younger people. Mm-hmm. And this is to cite what we were just saying about Cry Macho. Straight up young adult novel. This is like a fable out of sort of the R.L. Stine school.
Cool.
It was directed by David Yaroveski, who did that movie Brightburn.
Mm-hmm. Which I thought was a little I thought people were too eager to dismiss that. I thought that was a pretty clever little horror movie.
Cute. It's
what
like
if Superman. What if Superboy was a horror villain?
Yeah, yeah. It's a
good idea.
12-year-old Superman, but he's a murderer.
Yeah.
And
neat.
And he can essentially destroy the world. So why Dundee?
Yeah, that's a pretty good flick.
This film, it's done by the guy who did Brightburn. It's produced by Sam Raimi, so you know you're gonna get into something a little bit wilder. Mm-hmm. It's about a young boy. He's about 10, and we get to see him flee a haunted house birthday party where nobody's shown up. And he's tearing like posters off of his wall, and he's throwing away all of his horror books, and he's taking up big notebooks of stories he's written. He's saying, this is all stupid now. He's at the end of his rope from something in his life, and he's charging down to his New York building's furnace so he can burn all of his stories. Wouldn't you know it, on the way, he passes an apartment whose doors open a crack. What's inside but a plate of pumpkin pie and a TV playing his favorite movie, The Lost Boys.
And wow, we're at that point, huh?
Yeah,
that's the classic movie.
We're old, William.
It never stops being like all right.
And indeed,
because that's retro for a kid to be into. Like if we were like if that movie was made when we were kids, that would be like, the kid's favorite movie is Bride of Frankenstein. Like it's 40 years old now.
It's movies about 40 years old.
Just funny.
In fact, that song from The Lost Boys, that one, there's a cover of that at the end of this movie as well. So there's a few little parallels.
That's a great soundtrack, that movie. It was an amazing soundtrack.
He wanders in, kind of hypnotized by The Lost Boys. It's a red tinted and everything's really dark in this kind of spooky apartment. The door vanishes behind him, and he passes out after eating the pie. Mm-hmm. He wakes up, and wouldn't you know it, there's a witch with blue hair.
Nice.
She's played by Kristen Ritter.
Oh.
And she says, I'm going to eat the child. And she has another kid is there, and clearly she's been imprisoned by the witch for a while.
Yeah.
So she kidnaps children and will eat them. And he says, wait, I can tell you stories. He tries to Scheherazade his way out of this thing.
Yeah. Or Tales from the Dark Side, the movie.
Sure.
That's the modern version.
Scheherazade right up to Tales from the Dark Side, the movie. Yeah,
Tales from the Dark Side, the movie opens with Debbie Harry is a witch, and there's a little boy in a cage in her kitchen, and he's trying to delay her from cooking him by telling her scary stories that she might like.
And that's a great setup for an anthology film, but this is not an anthology film.
Okay.
Which was a little upsetting, because I thought that's where it was setting
seems
up for.
Seems like the natural place to go.
Yeah, so he sits on a stool with his book, she's sitting on a couch in her wild outfits with a hairless cat that can turn invisible. The invisible hairless cat is the source of one of the most disgusting sight gags I've seen in a while.
Wow.
Where he's eating breakfast and he puts down his sandwich and we see no cat, but a cat turd appear in the air.
Oh!
Like poops on his sandwich while the cat itself is invisible.
That's disgusting.
Yeah, it's pretty gross.
That's not nice.
Here's where this film is. It's willing to be a little gross, and it's willing to be a little bit scary.
It's a lot
and,
gross.
And it has that sort of wild, sort of, well, like, colorfully lit, busy production design of, like, a Tim Burton kind of a movie. Mm. And he starts to tell her stories, and the witch is outraged because all of the magic stuff he makes up isn't accurate.
Okay, that's like, cute.
Everybody knows ghosts can't haunt there. That's not what vampires do. And so she says, I sleep during the day. You have to write me stories during the day, and at night you read them to me. If they have happy endings, you're out. If they're inaccurate, you're out. So he starts going through her gigantic library, and she has the Library of Babel. Yeah. Like, yeah. She has this magical door, you open it up, and it stretches up for, you know, this gigantic tower inside the apartment.
Okay.
And it's full of, you know, millions of books. While he's researching, he actually finds notes written in the margins of the books left behind by other children. And he has found that maybe if he reads all of these notes left behind by previous children, he can find a way to escape. He has to tend to the witch's evil garden during the day, which has these really awesome little egg monsters. Like, the eggs hatch and these little kind of skull-faced tentacle monsters start chasing after the two children, and they're genuinely scary but also really cool looking.
You're making this sound really cool.
It's really cool. Nice. It's actually really exciting. There was a trend in horror from, like, the R.L. Stein era of it where I feel like children's horror wasn't trying to scare the children.
No.
It was bandying about with horror imagery, yeah. You know, werewolves and the living ventriloquist dummies and what have you.
The characters were scared, the reader was not.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This one is actually trying to engage with children to scare them.
All right.
It's rated PG. There's no, like, violence or, you know, anything truly disturbing in here, but this is something that might actually frighten a child. Mm. And I think that's very good. I think kids like being scared. If kids are anything the way I was really drawn to horror as a little kid. I liked scary stories. I was too afraid to read them, but I always wanted to hear about them. I liked sort of going into the horror section of my local video store and just sort of scare myself by looking at the scary covers of the movies. I wouldn't rent the movies. They were too frightening.
Yeah.
But I liked, you know, it's like I remember when A Nightmare on Elm Street Part 3 came out. There was an image on the back of the gigantic, like, slimy Freddy Krueger head swallowing a young girl whole.
Oh, yeah, like he's a giant worm.
Yeah, like he's a gigantic worm.
Still one of the great images of the series.
Yeah, just that image was on the back, and that scared the hell out of me. Oh, so yeah. Every time I would go, I'd, like, look at the back of that. And like, yep, still scared, all right. I feel like kids engage with horror movies in that way. They are drawn to them, even as they're scared by them. And, you know, you watch the Goosebumps movies. Those are fun. That first one especially.
First one's quite good, yeah.
But, yeah, they're not scary. There's not a lot of scary moments in that.
No.
Night Books is a frightening Hansel and Gretel type fable where kids are being held prisoner by an evil witch. And what are they going to do to get out of it? And it ends up playing into the Hansel and Gretel myth a lot. There's a unicorn that shows up, and it's a terrifying unicorn. Yeah, all these monsters and creatures and this weird prison three-hander between these two children and this evil witch. And Kristen Ritter, of course, is having a grand old time.
She's great.
Camping it up as this blue-haired witch. Yeah, this is really, really fun. All it's right. A good Halloween-type movie, like for a Halloween party-type movie.
Yeah. That's great.
And I feel like Netflix is really tapping into something with these horror movies for younger audiences. I know the Fear Street movies are rated R, but I think, you know,
high school
slumber party, even junior high slumber party movies, they function perfectly well, especially that first one.
Oh, yeah.
By the time you get to the third, it's like, no, you're involved in the mythology.
We're wrapping up the movies.
That's not a party movie
anymore. The
first
two kind of work on their own, but the last one is pretty much just a wrap up. It's still a good wrap up, though. But that's really cool. Okay, I'll have to check that out. That's exciting. All right, well, then the last thing that we're talking about today is a new comedy from directors Justin Long, who you may remember from movies.
I've seen him act.
And Christian Long, who I believe is his brother. They wrote and directed a comedy called Lady of the Manor, which stars Melanie Lynskey, international treasure Melanie Lynskey.
I like Melanie Lynskey.
Spectacularly underappreciated actor. She's really funny. She's great in dramatic roles. She can play a terrifying villain. I think on The Shield, she scared the crap out of me.
She She was in The Frighteners.
Yes, she was.
Briefly. She had no lines. Yeah. She was just a cop in the background.
Right.
But Peter Jackson made that movie. He wanted to do her a favor.
Because she was one of his co-stars in Heavenly Creatures, which is a great motion picture. So Melanie Lynskey plays a stoner. Who her whole gig is she gets stoned. That's about that. she gets stoned and she makes a living delivering weed to people's houses. She ends up delivering, she gets the address wrong. She goes to like something something street instead of something something avenue. Uh-huh. And she ends up accidentally walking into like a sting operation to catch sex predators. Mm-hmm. And now she has to actually like be on like a sex predators like registry. So now no one will hire her for anything. And the only thing she can get a job doing is working for Ryan Phillippe. Ryan Phillippe is this shitty old money douchebag who's never had to work a day in his life, and he's
played those numerous times, hasn't he?
Yeah, but this one's playing him like his 40s, but okay. He hasn't grown up, and it's actually kind of funny. He's been put in charge of the Family Manor, which is a tourist attraction.
Okay.
People go in, and then they have like a tour guide who pretends to be the lady of the manor, dresses in the clothes, and welcome to my house. I was born in 1870. And I was, then I died under mysterious circumstances, that kind of thing. And he hires her to be the new one of those because the previous one wouldn't sleep with him. And Melanie Lynskey has no standards.
Oh,
and
no.
She's just like, sure, whatever. And so she gets a free place to stay and she gets to do this gig and she does absolutely no research whatsoever. And she's making it all up as she goes along and she pisses off the ghost of the house so much that Judy Greer shows up and says, you're doing it wrong.
Judy Greer is the ghost. Okay. I love Melanie Lynskey. And yes. I love Judy Greer.
That's a great two-hander for any movie. I wish this movie was funnier.
Oh,
I really, really do. They just
it's
putting
like,
them.
It's another Blythe Spirit.
It's not. Well, I didn't see the new Blythe Spirit. The original Blythe Spirit's great, but like
they got a good cast and they just whittled it away.
I the setup is kind of funny. There's a lot of potential here to really talk about because it's set in the South. Judy Greer was sort of a rich lady, but it was like after the Civil War, and so like, but it still feels like we're dancing around some shitty history here, and we just refuse to engage with it.
Okay.
But even if you leave that out, this is a very chillaxed movie, and I think to a fault. It's obviously a cheap production. That's not the end of the world, but it never really feels like this is an actual historical house. I'm going off that on faith more than anything. It doesn't really feel like we're in like a fancy old place that's been like preserved in any way. It feels like a nice house and you put some old stuff in it. Melanie Lynskey is funny. Judy Greer are funny. They actually don't have any scenes together for way too long. Once they do, they're mostly inseparable. But also once they do, they have less to do together than you'd think. And more of it than I really was happy with involves farting. Like, there's more farting than I thought there'd be in this movie. And listen, I'm not saying there's no such thing as a good fart joke, but it's been mined to death. Like, it's hard to do, and I don't think... I think this movie has, like, one good fart joke in it out of, like, 20. It's a lot of fart jokes.
The fart joke is a gentle art.
It is.
And
doing it right is difficult.
Yeah, I. If you see it in a kid's movie, it's bad.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen a good fart joke in a kid's movie.
I can't recall.
Often they're just vulgar, but occasionally they're so vulgar you love them. Blazing Saddles remains
classic,
the gold standard.
Gold standard, classic fart jokes. Again, there are good fart jokes, but they're hard to pull off. This one doesn't quite nail that. I think it was Gene Siskel who had the expression, which is what would be more entertaining, this movie or watching the same cast have dinner?
Yeah, that's a Siskelism.
Yeah, and I was thinking about that a lot when I was watching this because especially at the end credits when they have a lot of bloopers, the bloopers are funnier than the movie.
Oh.
Just seeing Judy Greer just pal around with Melanie Lynskey and, like, do silly jokes that have nothing to do with the plot so they couldn't be making it into the movie. They're so wonderful together. I just want to listen to their podcast. The movie itself isn't that great. It's not a lot of laughs in it. It's the story is thin, but that's not the biggest problem with it. It's nice to see Melanie Lynskey, like, throw herself into this really unlikable character because she's Melanie Lynskey, and she can't actually do that. Like, she can't be unlikable, but she's can play a character who should be unlikable. But it's just basically her personality, her persona, her delivery makes that character very palatable. Whereas I think almost any other actor, they would just be hard to watch.
Oh, okay.
I guess that's what I'm saying here. I think she makes a difficult character work. But yeah, the overall, just the comic timing on the movie is very slack. The writing isn't as sharp as it could be. It doesn't really engage with what it's really talking about. And it's a bit of a waste of the cast, unfortunately. If you really, really like Melanie Lynskey and Judy Greer, and admittedly you should, might be worth a watch. But I wouldn't expect a lot from it. This has like that straight to video patina on it back when that meant like this is only so good, like it's that. But again, Judy Greer is a delight. Melanie Lynskey is a delight. That's about as far as I can go with it. So on the critically acclaimed scale, that's how we review our movies. We review films on a scale of C- to C+. C is average, some good, some bad, bada bing. Average.
Bob's your uncle.
C+ is above average. That's everything from we genuinely recommend it to this is the best movie ever made. Anything in that area, boom, C+. And C- is below average. Generally speaking, we don't recommend it to the worst thing ever. And on that note, I do have to give Lady of the Manor a C-. It's a mild C-. I'm not mad at the movie or anything like that. I just don't really know who to recommend this to unless you're like a really hardcore Melanie Lynskey, Judy Greer fan. and I imagine you're out there, so fair enough. But I think everyone else is going to find this just a little limp. And it's a bit disappointing. Yeah. What about Nightbooks?
Nightbooks, I'm going to give that a C+.
Nice.
I think this is, sweet, colorful, energetic story about young kids who are into horror, and it's also genuinely scary for little kids. It's just really sweet, great little film.
That's great. Okay, Cry Macho.
A C.
Okay.
It's gentle, so gentle it's not really leaving much of an impact. Clint Eastwood can handle this kind of material, but there's a lot in it that's a little peculiar. A lot of it that's so gentle it becomes insubstantial. But it's not a failure. Still, sweet and watchable and relaxing.
I don't know. I find the fact that it's a little insubstantial to be surprisingly full of substance.
Okay.
When you think about how the various types of Westerns, modern or classic, Clint has made in the past. To see him make one that shows, like, this Western mentality today is something that is just sort of fading out and we don't really need macho-ness anymore.
Yeah.
There's something about just how insubstantial this is that feels like a statement about what happened to masculinity and what happened to the Western.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of zen about it. And it's sort of like, and maybe we're all a little better off for that. So I'm going to give this a mild C+. Not a huge C+, not a best films of the year probably, but... I did like watching it. I do appreciate what I think Clint Eastwood's going for here, and I was affected. I liked it a bit. And then lastly, The Eyes of Tammy.
That's a C+.
That's a C+ for me. Not a big C+, but it's definitely recommended. And lastly, The Eyes of Tammy Faye.
I like the lead performances a lot, but yeah, I think what I was complaining about, how it sort of brushes up against this much larger, more interesting story and then doesn't delve, was frustrating enough to keep it from being a great film.
Yeah.
Even though Jessica Chastain and Andrew Garfield really nail it. I'm just going to give it a C.
Yeah.
But it was really close.
Yeah.
There was something there that they really could have explored.
I agree with everything that you're saying. I agree that it never quite becomes a great film, but I do think it is consistently a good film. So I'm going to give it a C+.
Okay.
It definitely could have been like, wow, what an amazing motion picture. Holy crap. But I think even if this was just a decent biopic with these two great lead performances in it, that's enough to recommend for me.
Okay.
So that's a C+ for me as well. So that is critically acclaimed for this week. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We think you're neat. You're all really, really cool.
Every one of you.
Yeah. And I want to give a very special shout out to all of our patrons over patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. Without you, this show wouldn't exist. None of our shows would exist. We can never get over that. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. If you want to join up, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We have a lot of exclusive shows over there for you to enjoy. We have an online hangout coming later this week. And shows dedicated to the Oscars, Star Trek, Batman, commentary tracks. Galore. So we got that. If you want to join in the conversation, there's a couple of different ways to do that. Most prominently, you can write us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We might read your email on an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail, so feel free to ask us questions, take us to task, ask for recommendations, whatever you want, basically. Mm-hmm. The floor is yours. We also have a P.O. box for those who prefer to interact the old-fashioned way.
Yeah, write us in an actual physical letter. Our P.O. box is Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
And, of course, we're on Twitter. We are at Critic Acclaim, all one word. Or we are individually at William Bibiani.
I am at Whitney Seibel.
I have a soap store with my partner, M. Lapis Da Silva. It's called Salt Cat Soap. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Salt Cat Soap. And there's also on Facebook as well. We just added that page. And there are links to our store on Etsy. We have a lot of new soaps that we've debuted in September. And stick around because we're making some really fun Halloween soaps that we're going to debut in the near future. They're pretty cool, actually. This is stuff we've never done before, and it's really, really neat. But don't let that deter you from getting anything now, because if you buy something now, you get a 10% off coupon you can use later. So enjoy. And Whitney, tell them about your other podcast.
It's about to go monthly, but it's still a weekly podcast. There's 17 episodes so far that I do over on the Screen's Margins with 1B Peterson. They and I discuss what we saw on Ovid that week. Ovid is a really great streaming service. They offer all of the deep cut art house stuff that you saw playing in your local museum and you couldn't make it to because it was 9:30 on a Wednesday. Or films you didn't want to carve out time for because they were over 5.5 hours in length.
Or films that no matter how good they are, various distributors in America balk I don't see an advertising hook here, you know?
Yeah, if you're familiar with the studio's Icarus films or Grasshopper films, they do a lot of international distribution. All those movies end up settling on Ovid. And B and I have been watching just whatever we want on Ovid, and we've had some pretty interesting conversations. We haven't found a dud yet.
Wow.
There hasn't been any that's been, like, truly disappointing. You watch the Criterion Channel, you might run into a bad one here or there.
Sometimes they're historically significant, but not necessarily good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ovid is nothing but gems. So, yeah, we have conversations. It's called All About Ovid, with all O's. On the last episode, I got to talk about Hotel Terminus, which is a 4.5-hour documentary about the Nazi torturer Klaus Barbie. And and how for about 40 years he was abetted by the American government. Ugh. So it's an incredibly incredibly depressing film. But it's the kind of film that is available on Ovid, and I think it's actually a very valuable movie. And I talked about other great films besides, like discovered a Japanese film called Happy Hour, which is really, really wonderful. They have Tsai Ming-Liang films, they have Lav Diaz films, and B and I have some very interesting conversations.
Yeah, so head on over
about what's on Ovid.
So head on over to the Screen's Margins, and by all means, while you're there, look around. Mm. B. Peterson has put up a lot of their... a lot of their Patreon exclusive content is now currently available just on that service. And that is a font of really excellent cinema studies stuff, like deep dive stuff, like a whole giant retrospective on the works of Dorothy Arzner, who, if you don't know that name, you should. Podcasts about Frederick Wiseman, like a lot of really cool stuff. So check them out, please do. Anyway, I guess that's about it for Critically Acclaimed. Thank you, everybody, once again for listening. Have a great week. And never forget, everyone's a critic.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?